Guelph is a presentation of Music Eddies, the Aramasa Institute, the University of Guelph, and the Literary Review of Canada.
Whether you're a cinema buff or just someone who wants to know more about movies new and old, then Silver Screen Dream Machine is for you. Tune in on Fridays from 1 to 2 p.m. for the radio show all about movies and moving media. The show features cinema-related interviews, movie reviews, theater listings, soundtracks, and tons of great music. We're always looking for contributors of all kinds, so stop by or call 519-837-2378 during the show or email silverscreen@cfru.ca and come and join the Silver Screen Dream Machine team.
On Friday, November 13th, at the River Run Center, the Guelph Lecture on Being Canadian will continue to foster public dialogue on and a greater understanding of ideas and issues of concern to Canadians. The evening will include a keynote address by computer scientist, composer, and author Jaron Lanier, a reading from Lee Miracle of her most recent work, and new music by Peter Hatch, performed by the Penderecki String Quartet and DJ Cyclist. Tickets are $20 for adults and $15 for students and seniors, and available online at riverrun.ca. The River Run Center is located at 35 Woolwich Street, a physically accessible location. For more information, visit guelphlecture.ca.
Hi, I'm James Gordon, and you are fortunate enough to be listening to CFRU 93.3 FM in Guelph.
You're listening to Back in USSR.
Да здравствует 60-я годовщина Великой Октябрьской социалистической революции. Да здравствует героический советский народ и его доблестные вооруженные силы. Слава Коммунистической партии Советского Союза, руководящей и направляющей силе советского общества. Ура!
Thank you.
You're listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. I am Siegfried, and this is the 98th anniversary of the Bolshevik Revolution of 1917, which we are marking on the show here today. Why exactly are we marking this anniversary? Well, I'm glad you asked. The reason being is because the future, in the future of humankind, and I think this is very, very evident given the pictures of the future that we get in popular culture today, we have a choice between socialism and barbarism. And I'm serious about this. We either develop a society which serves the needs of human beings and places human life before profit, or we will destroy ourselves. This is the stark choice that we face in the 21st century, especially as we face the potentially catastrophic environmental changes that humankind has wrought upon this world. Now, one of the things which I'm really going to talk about, and I talked about this actually earlier this week at a Young Communist League meeting here in educational, at the University of Guelph earlier this week, on the historical successes of socialism, you know, of working class control over society and over the means of production. You know, I'm going to talk about that here tonight and really kind of try to bring it home to you that a society where there is no exploitation, you know, a society without oppression, systemic oppression and structural oppression, the society based on human needs and not corporate greed and the demand for profit, that such a society can be built, has been built, and can be and must be built again. So that's what I'm going to talk about here tonight. Now, and I can't think of a better way to mark the 98th anniversary of the Bolshevik Revolution and really bring it home about like what it really is all about. So the socialist societies that emerged in the 20th century, they shared a common experience in that none of them was afforded the luxury of peaceful development. This goes basically all of them, you know, virtually without exception. Throughout their history, from the revolutions that gave them birth to the present day for those of them that survived, they were subject to embargoes and sanctions, covert action and sabotage, subversion and civil war, military invasion and threats of nuclear annihilation. The Soviet Union, as the world's first socialist state, is case in point. By 1919, the militaries of more than 14 different countries, including the United States, Britain, France, Canada, Germany, Japan, and others, had intervened in Russia in an attempt to stop the Bolshevik Revolution, thus forcing the infant socialist republic to fight for its own survival against all odds. It was right after the Russian Revolution. In subsequent decades, Korea, Vietnam, Cuba, Angola, Mozambique, Laos, Cambodia, Nicaragua, Grenada, and other socialist states would likewise face the full brunt of armed aggression at the hands of the world's capitalist powers and their local proxies. You know, trying to break the new revolutionary societies before they could consolidate themselves and the gains that they had made. And it follows that the achievements of socialism in terms of economic development, education, healthcare, human services, gender and national equality, technological and scientific achievement, and other progressive indicators become all the more impressive when one realizes that all of these gains were made in a state of constant siege and insecurity. The Soviet Union came into being during a world war, immediately faced civil war and foreign invasion, had to rebuild its shattered economy, making painful compromises in the process, and then construct what had never been constructed before, a socialist economy with no blueprint or past example to go on. And even after facing these immense obstacles, the USSR was then confronted with genocidal Nazi invasion and war on an almost apocalyptic scale in the Second World War, being forced to rebuild from the ground up once again after losing tens of millions of its own people. All of this before being faced with the Cold War and the threat of massive nuclear preemptive strike by the United States, which is an aggressive stance that the U.S. maintains to this day with regard to its nuclear forces. And yet the USSR managed to do what was previously thought unthinkable. You know, in spite of all of this, it was able to do what was previously thought unthinkable, and which the powers that be in the post-Cold War era strive to make unthinkable again. The USSR managed to build a society without exploitation. And I'll give you a quote from an amazing book called Socialism Betrayed, Behind the Collapse of the Soviet Union, by two historians, Roger Kieran and Thomas Kenny. And this is what they say about really what that means, a society without exploitation. They say, a brief review of the Soviet Union's accomplishments underscores what was lost when the Soviet Union collapsed. The Soviet Union not only eliminated the exploiting classes of the old order, but also ended inflation, unemployment, racial and national discrimination, grinding poverty, and glaring inequalities of wealth, income, education, and opportunity. In 50 years, the country went from an industrial production that was only 12% of that in the United States to industrial production that was over 80% and an agricultural output 85% of the U.S. Though Soviet per capita consumption remained lower than in the U.S., no society had ever increased living standards and consumption so rapidly in such a short period of time for all its people. Employment was guaranteed. Free education was available for all, from kindergarten through secondary schools, general, technical, and vocational, universities, and after-work schools. Besides free tuition, post-secondary students received living stipends. Free health care existed for all, and with about twice as many doctors per person as in the United States. Workers who were injured or ill had job guarantees and sick pay. In the mid-1970s, workers averaged 21.2 working days of vacation, so a month's vacation each year, and sanitariums, resorts, and children's camps were either free or subsidized. Trade unions had the power to veto firings and recall managers. The state regulated all prices and subsidized the cost of basic food and housing. Rents constituted only 2 to 3% of the family budget. Water and utilities only 4 to 5%. No segregated housing by income existed. Though some neighborhoods were reserved for high officials, elsewhere plant managers, nurses, professors, and janitors lived side by side. The government included cultural and intellectual growth as part of its effort to enhance living standards. State subsidies kept the price of books, periodicals, and cultural events at a minimum. As a result, workers often owned their own libraries, and the average family subscribed to 4 periodicals. That's like, you know, magazines, newspapers, journal articles. The average family subscribed to 4 of those, and every year they would get them. And UNESCO reported that Soviet citizens read more books and saw more films than any other people in the world. Every year, the number of people visiting museums equaled nearly half the entire population, and attendance at theaters, concerts, and other performances surpassed the total population. The government made a concerted effort to raise the literacy and living standards of the most backward areas of the country and to encourage the cultural expression of the more than 100 nationality groups that constituted the Soviet Union. In Kyrgyzstan, for example, only 1 out of every 500 people could read and write in 1917, but 50 years later, nearly everyone could. You know, so that's what happened in the Soviet Union. You know, they eliminated all these kind of things which seem intractable problems in many societies around the world, whether it's illiteracy or healthcare or what have you, you know, or, you know, all these different things which, you know, all these different systemic problems that so many countries are still facing. Those were eliminated in the Soviet Union and other socialist countries because of socialism, you know, because of a economy that was under public control and could be directed to serve the public need and the public good. Now, here's another example which I want to give you. And this is from Michael Parenti's book, Black Shirts and Reds. This is about Cuba and the Cuban experience of socialism. And he writes, traveling across Cuba in 1959, immediately after the overthrow of the U.S.-supported right-wing Batista dictatorship, Mike Faulkner witnessed a spectacle of almost unrelieved poverty. The rural population lived in makeshift shacks without minimal sanitation. Malnourished children went barefoot in the dirt and suffered the familiar plague of parasites common in the Third World. There were almost no doctors or schools. And through much of the year, families that depended solely on the seasonal sugar harvest lived close to starvation. Today, Cuba is a different place. For all its mistakes and abuses, the Cuban Revolution brought sanitation, schools, health clinics, jobs, housing, and human services to a level not found throughout most of the Third World, and in many parts of the First World. Infant mortality in Cuba has dropped from 60 per thousand in 1960 to 9.7 per thousand by 1991, and it's gotten better even since then, while life expectancy rose from 55 to 75 in the same period. Smallpox, malaria, tuberculosis, typhoid, polio, and numerous other diseases have been wiped out by improved living standards and public health programs. Cuba has enjoyed a level of literacy higher than in the United States, and a life expectancy that compares well with advanced industrial nations. Yes, that's Cuba. So, you know, all these achievements were made in socialist societies. You know, and Cuba, even today, you know, the WHO, the World Health Organization, openly acknowledges that the Cuba is a world leader when it comes to turning out advanced, you know, very highly skilled doctors and health practitioners who practice medicine not only in Cuba itself, but, like, you know, at least 50,000 Cuban medical practitioners are engaged in healthcare around the world, in countries around the world, throughout the Third World, and most noticeably recently in Western Africa, where they played a pivotal role in fighting the Ebola outbreak. You know, Cuba sent like several thousand doctors to combat the Ebola outbreak. Meanwhile, the United States, the American Empire, have sent thousands of soldiers. You know, which I think, you know, says a lot about the difference between American and Cuban diplomacy. And I'll give you another quote from Michael Parenti. He says, "To say that socialism doesn't work is to overlook the fact that it did. In Eastern Europe, Russia, China, Mongolia, North Korea, and Cuba, revolutionary communism created a life for the mass of people that was far better than the wretched existence they had endured under feudal lords, military bosses, foreign colonizers, and Western capitalists. The end result was a dramatic improvement in living conditions for hundreds of millions of people on a scale never before or since witnessed in history." You know, so the socialist countries in the 20th century raised more people out of poverty in a relatively short space of time than had ever been done before in human history. And that's massive. And the Russian Revolution, the Bolshevik Revolution of 1917, of which we commemorating the 98th anniversary of today on this show, was what ushered in that entire process, you know, of empowering people, raising them out of poverty, putting power into their hands, economic and political power, the ability to determine their own lives, their own futures, their own destinies. You know, all of that was made possible by what was achieved in Russia in 1917 and the inspiration that that gave to liberation movements worldwide. You know, encouraging them to fight, you know, for their own, to basically be able to control their own lives, whether that's working people in the West or whether that's colonized people in the Third World who are fighting to overthrow imperialism. You know, it gave them hope, it gave them light, it gave them strength, gave them inspiration to fight with an understanding that they can win and they can build a dignified future for themselves and for their children. You know, so that's what we're celebrating here tonight. You know, and so I'm going to play a song which I think really captures this kind of spirit of the Revolution of 1917. And this is by a Soviet singer, Lev Lutsenko, and this is called "Lenin is Young Again." Lenin Kakoy Malodoy.
Стяг, жизни важен первый шаг. Слышишь, веют над страною ветры яростных атак. вновь продолжает с собой. И сердцу тревожно в груди, и Ленин такой молодой, и юный октябрь впереди. И Ленин такой молодой, и юный октябрь впереди. Весь летит во все концы, вы поверьте нам, отцы. Будут новые победы, станут новые бойцы. И вновь продолжает с собой, и сердцу тревожно в груди. И Ленин такой молодой, и юный октябрь впереди. Милости не жди, жизнь для правды не щади. Нам, ребята, в этой жизни только с правдой по пути. И вновь продолжает с собой, и сердцу тревожно в груди. И Ленин такой молодой, и юный октябрь впереди.
Okay, so that was Lev Lutsenko with Lenin is Young Again, Lenin Kakoy Malodoy, and that was, of course, a song about Vladimir Lenin, leader of the Bolshevik Revolution of 1917, and once again, the inspiration that he provided, you know, like that he is, Lenin is young again, you know, he's inspiring future generations, you know, generations beyond 1917 to rise up and struggle for self-determination around the world for working class people. And oppressed peoples of all kind. And, you know, that's really the spirit of 1917 and really what was achieved there. You know, it was a shining light that that inspired revolutionary movements around the world. And one of those revolutionary movements that did get inspired in recent decades was, of course, the an example of which not many people know about. I mean, it's one of those things that doesn't really get mentioned very much. And it's the example of Grenada. Now, Grenada is a small island in the Caribbean. You know, like many people know about the revolution in Cuba, few people know about the New Jewel movement and Maurice Bishop and the revolution in Grenada, which took place in the late 1970s. In 1979 it took place. And then it was overthrown in 1984 when the United States invaded and toppled the revolutionary government through direct military force intervention. And this was a very small country, not a lot of resources, even less resources than Cuba had available to it. Yet it had its own revolution, It had only recently stopped becoming a British colony. For a long time, it was a British colony, very much locked into basically producing things like sugarcane and things like that for export, very plantation-oriented economy and tourism-oriented economy. Local people lived in desperate poverty, and they did not have control of their own lives. They didn't have, like, the support systems of a modern society. And of course, they were oppressed. They were exploited, you know, so that that agribusiness and tourist, the tourist industry and stuff could, of course, make a profit from their labor. And Maurice Bishop, when he in the New Jewel movement that he led, that was Marxist-Leninist organization, took power there, you know, and reoriented the economy towards the needs of the Grenadian people, you know, and built this revolutionary example, the second revolutionary example to be built in the Caribbean region after Cuba, you know, and they stood in solidarity with other third world liberation struggles in Africa and Latin America and Asia. You know, it showed what even the most downtrodden and oppressed and impoverished peoples in the world can accomplish. You know, and of course, that was an example which the United States and the American Empire felt it had to destroy. And so that's what led to the invasion of Grenada in 1983-84 and the overthrow of that revolution. You know, and that only happened in fact, like the anniversary of it, I think, just happened on the, I believe it was the 18th of October, you know, so just a few weeks ago. So there was a really good piece on the Real News Network about this that Jared Ball on the Real News Network was actually talking to a former minister from Maurice Bishop's revolutionary government in Grenada and, you know, about the revolution, really the lessons that it has for people rising up against, you know, imperialism and capitalism today, and including even movements like Black Lives Matter. So I'm going to play that right now. So please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
Usually every year at the end of December, we announce what the next year will be called. You know, year of education, production, or whatever it is. But last month, 6.5 months ahead of schedule, we announced to our people what the name of next year will be. So they can start from now to mobilize, including mobilizing overseas around the name. Because 1984 next year will be called the Year of International Air.
Welcome, everyone, back to the Real News Network. I'm Jared Ball here in Baltimore. October 19th has again come and gone with not enough attention paid to an important and sad anniversary that it marks. On that date in 1983, the inspirational and brilliant revolutionary leader Maurice Bishop was assassinated in his home country of Grenada, a country that had become at the time seen as a threat to imperialism in the West and therefore a target of the Reagan administration. Joining us to talk briefly about his comrade is Bishop's former press secretary, veteran activist and journalist Don Rojas. Don, welcome to the Real News.
Hey, thank you, Jared. Good to be with you, bro.
So let's just start with the simple question of who was Maurice Bishop, right. And if you can, tell us a little bit about the history of Grenada to fill people in,
and catch
us up on who this great man was.
Sure. Well, Maurice Bishop was the leader of the People's Revolutionary Government and the head of the New Jewel Movement, which was the vanguard political party that had carried out a struggle for a number of years against a dictatorship led by Prime Minister Eric Gehry. That party, in fact, overthrew the dictatorship on March 13, 1979, and with the support of the masses of the Grenadian people, the vast majority, took power and held on to that power for 4.5 years, right up until, as you just pointed out, October 19th, 1983, when Maurice Bishop was killed by an internal coup d'etat led by a faction of the military, of the Grenadian military. He and a number of his colleagues, ministers of government, other leaders of the New Jewel Movement, were assassinated. And as a result of that, pretty much the revolution imploded. So when the U.S. U.S. imperialism looking at what was happening inside of Grenada and seizing on an opportunity to do exactly what they had been planning to do for right since 1981. In fact, they had military exercises that were carried out in Vieques Island, just off of Puerto Rico, that were in fact a dress rehearsal for an invasion of Grenada whenever the opportunity arose. And here, this opportunity did arise, and under the pretext of rescuing, quote-unquote, American medical students who were studying on the island at the time, the U.S., under President Reagan's command, invaded Grenada and crushed the revolution, or what was left of the revolution after Bishop was killed, and occupied the country for well over a year subsequent to the invasion, thus bringing an end to an experiment, a noble experiment in self-determined political, social, and economic development led by the representatives of the Grenadian people in the form of the People's Revolutionary Government, an anti-imperialist revolution that set upon a path of developing an independent nation that was, in fact, had become a beacon for the entire Caribbean region. So it was a great tragedy, not just for the Grenadian people, when the revolution was destroyed from within, and then on top of that, the U.S. invasion. But it was a tragedy for the entire region, because Grenada had begun to express itself as the vanguard force throughout the region, and attracted tremendous support from activists, from progressive people, particularly young people from around the country, around the Caribbean region, who came to Grenada during those years, the 4.5 years, volunteered their time and their talents and their efforts, became involved themselves in the process of building an independent nation in Grenada. And then many of them went back to pursue the struggles for independence in their own countries. It was a period 32 years ago, as you said, the anniversary just passed, that opened up a whole new chapter in the history of the Caribbean region.
Tell us a little bit about the New Jewel movement and what its goals were, what it had already successfully implemented, what mm-hmm. made it a threat to the West and to mm-hmm. imperialism. And we understand that Bishop was openly Marxist, and mm-hmm. this caused problems. But tell us a little bit about how he deployed his Marxism in that region and what was being accomplished.
Well, he was a very realistic Marxist in the sense that he understood the process of dialectical and historical materialism, and that building a revolution with the involvement of the masses of the people would take time. It was a protracted process. He also understood that process would always be opposed by U.S. imperialism, given the fact that this experiment in an independent sovereign development was taking place in what the U.S. had always considered to be its backyard, the Caribbean Latin American region, given too the whole history of U.S. imperialist interventions in our region, going all the way back to the Monroe Doctrine in the middle of the 19th century. And the invasion and occupation of places like Haiti in 1915, for 20 years, the U.S. military occupied the country of Haiti. They look at what all the attempts to overthrow the Cuban Revolution that came to power in 1959. So this particular region was a very sensitive geostrategic region for U.S. imperialism. And they vowed not to allow another Cuba to emerge and to consolidate in that region. So from the very first day of the revolution's triumph, U.S. imperialism carried out a protracted process of destabilizing the revolution, economically, politically, diplomatically, etc., to isolate Grenada within the Caribbean region and beyond. They were particularly upset at the close ties that had begun to develop between Grenada and Cuba, and the close personal relationship between Fidel Castro and Maurice Bishop.
So just very lastly, you know, in the moment we're in now Black Lives Matter, right, and police brutality here in the United States and really all around the world, actually, and a lot of young people joining movements for the first time and organization and activism for the first time, right, having your experience, because not only with this, but you have a long experience with activist politics, right, that we would love to have another conversation with you about, right, at some point. You mentioned that Bishop represented something not only for Grenada, but for the Caribbean and for international struggle. What do you think we can learn or could be passed on to young folks today, given this experience and your experience or the particulars around Bishop's assassination,
right,
and his struggle and the development of the revolution, development of ideas, or, you know, anything that you think could inform or should inform young people today from this particular experience?
Well, there's so many examples, there's so many parallels, actually, to what's happening today with the Black Lives Matter movement. The resistance to police oppression, the resistance to all forms of violence inflicted on the black community by structural racism and institutionalized racism. Bishop, back in the day, 30 years ago, struggled against the very same forces in the context of the Caribbean region. Also, you know, you're talking about building a nation that had been for years a colony of Britain, that had achieved its nominal independence, what we call flag independence, but taking such a nation into a new stage of development that was sovereign, that was independent, that was progressive. Those are lessons, I think, that the leaders of the movement today, the Black Lives Matter movement, would do well to study some of the lessons coming out of that experience in Grenada. There are lessons of how to struggle against, you know, the various manifestations of an imperial of an empire, right? I mean, the empire operating here in the United States and operating outside of the United States, operate very similar tactics. You know, should be studied, and there are lots of lessons that Bishop and his fellow revolutionaries have left behind for the contemporary generation of freedom fighters and resistance fighters to incorporate and to study and to build into their strategies as they move forward. So, I mean, don't forget there's a long history of relationship between influence of freedom fighters in the United States, like Malcolm X and Martin Luther King and Stokely Carmichael, Kwame Ture, and so on the revolutionary movement in the Caribbean region. There's been historical ties going all the way back to Marcus Garvey. So, you know, Marcus Garvey was from Jamaica. Marcus Garvey came to the United States and built the largest mass movement of black people that the world had ever seen.
That's right.
Right? Then you have people like C.L.R. James from Trinidad and Tobago, brilliant Marxist revolutionary intellectual who spent a lot of time struggling and organizing workers, black workers here in the United States, particularly in the Detroit area. So there's a whole...
And my favorite, Claudia Jones. I can shout her out real quick,
right,
too, coming from the Caribbean and doing the same kind of work. But yeah, anyway.
Exactly.
Just, yeah.
I mean, there's so many examples, mm-hmm, right? And so those synergies, those historical connections have always been there.
True.
And I'd love to see, you know, a revival of that. And in fact, that's going to be happening.
Well, before he was killed, Maurice Bishop said that 1984 was to be the year of international labor.
Yes.
Let's hope that 2016 takes up that mantle as well. You know, I would like to see that extended as well.
Absolutely. And I'd also like to see the Black Lives Matter movement and the reparations movement join forces in this now and next year within the context of the UN's Decade for People of African Descent, which is another topic hopefully we'll discuss at some point.
No question. Don Rojas, thanks for joining us here at The Real News.
My pleasure, bro. My pleasure.
And thank you for joining us here at The Real News. And for all involved, again, I'm Jared Ball here in Baltimore, saying, as Fred Hampton used to say, to you we say peace if you're willing to fight for it. So peace, everybody, and we'll catch you in the whirlwind.
Sisters and brothers, I think it really is time to close. Long live Grenada.
But tonight, a lot of people are going to suffer tonight. Cause the battle is getting hotter in this iration. It's Armageddon. A lot of people won't get no justice tonight. So a lot of people going to have to stand up and fight. But remember to praise Jehovah, and Jesus will guide you in this iration. It's Armageddon.
Start popping the popcorn. The Guelph Film Festival is almost here. From November 5th to 8th, the town will be bursting with outstanding documentaries from around the world, along with visiting directors, workshops, and post-film discussions. If you are interested in issues of social justice, the environment, and community building, then this is the festival for you. Visit GuelphFilmFestival.ca to see the full lineup and plan your schedule. Have a cultural experience like no other. That's GuelphFilmFestival.ca.
Pour les francophones et francophiles de la région, CFRU diffuse l'Éclipse, l'émission musicale française à tous les vendredis de 9h à 10h le matin. Si vous faites partie d'une groupe ou une organisation francophone locale qui veut se faire distinguer ou bien vous voulez contribuer à notre programme, s'il vous plaît, me contactez, Sandra Doucette, par courriel francophone@cfru.ca. Soyez à l'écoute tous les vendredis de 9h à 10h pour les annonces, des événements, d'actualité et bien sûr la bonne musique française.
Hi, I'm Handel, and I volunteer at CFRU because I love working with the people here, and I also love the feeling of contributing something meaningful to the world.
CFRU is always looking for new volunteers. No experience is necessary, and all the training is free. If you would like to get involved, email volunteer@cfru.ca.
Hi, my name is Jeff, and I love CFRU because it introduces me to all kinds of music I would otherwise not have heard. And there's a vending machine down the hall.
You listen to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. So before the break, we had Willie Williams with Armageddon Time. And, of course, we had the former minister of Maurice Bishop's government in Grenada, revolutionary government in Grenada, talking to Jared Ball of the Real News Network about really the lessons that the different revolutionary groups can take going forward from the experience of the New Jewel movement in Grenada and its confrontation with American imperialism. Now, there's another thing which I think I really should mention, like discuss, or, you know, tonight. And, of course, that is, you know, of course, the swearing in of a new government in this country, in Canada. Of course, we have Justin Trudeau's government. His cabinet was just recently sworn in. It's getting a lot of fanfare because, of course, it's 50-50 men and women. And, you know, there's been a lot of, like, you know, understandable euphoria from certain sections of the left, like in the idea that, you know, in comparison with Stephen Harper's government, needless to say, having a 50-50 split in government between men and women and having like a Aboriginal woman as the justice minister and things like this certainly make a splash, and they make they certainly make people feel that frankly all is well in this country. Now, needless to say, I am somewhat I have said this multiple times on this show. I am quite skeptical of the of Justin Trudeau and his vague promises of change, just as I was skeptical of Barack Obama when he made those same sort of promises, you know, the whole change we can believe in kind of thing, you know, like which he did in 2008. And everybody thought it was so radical back then that a black man was appointed Secretary of the Justice Department in the United States and was theoretically head of all police. Just as people are really kind of freaking out right now that there's a woman, an Aboriginal woman, is now justice minister and technically chief of all police in this country. You know, and people think that is so radical and that's going to change everything. And of course, as we know, with the experience of Eric Holder in that position in the United States, frankly, nothing really changed. Because the structure is the key. Not the individual who is the minister or the secretary or whoever it is. It's the structure of the government, you know, of the socioeconomic institutions of society. That's the real game. And if those institutions are racist, if those structures are racist, if those are hostile to Aboriginal people, it doesn't matter who you have in the position of justice minister. As long as it's still a capitalist society, it's still based on colonialism, it's still based on all those structural things that have been built up even before Confederation even happened in this country, you know, and even before the Declaration of Independence in the United States, you know, all these kind of things, you know, cannot be fixed by appointing a single, like a person of color to those positions. They will, in many cases, do the exact same thing that their white predecessors did. They will be faithful servants of the system, even though that system victimizes their own people. You know, and there's a very good article that recently came out on Rebel Youth, which is the Young Communist League's website. It's called Seven Reasons Why the Trudeau Government is a Big Business Government. And this was done by Drew Garvey. He's an amazing guy. He used to be the Communist Party candidate in this riding, actually, in Guelph, before I ran. And, you know, he brings up multiple things. I mean, I can't go into all these things in detail. He brings up seven points. Number one on austerity and infrastructure spending. Number two on free trade. Number three on First Nations. Number four on climate change. Number five on war and occupation. Number six on civil liberties and democratic rights. And number seven on immigrant rights and racism. And all of these things, he finds that the liberals don't have, needless to say, the greatest record on these things. When it comes to immigration rights and racism, it was the liberals that actually created the temporary foreign workers program that the Tories then expanded. And the Canadian Border Services Agency, which the Tories used to help deport 100,000 people, you know. And the liberals also voted for the Barbaric Cultural Practices Act. Liberals voted for that. This very racist piece of legislation tabled by the Harper Tories. The liberals supported that. When it comes to civil liberties and democratic rights, the liberals voted in favor of Bill C-51. You know, and after the September 11th attacks, when there was a liberal government in power in this country, you know, they were the ones who expanded Canada's police state and created security certificates, you know, which have shattered the lives of innocent people. You know, these, you know, when it comes to war and occupation, you know, Trudeau promised to end Canada's illegal bombing of Iraq and Syria, but he also pledged to continue training militants in those countries. You know, and to continue participating in the 15-year-old war on terror, which has led to 1 or 2 million deaths in the region, in the Middle East. You know, and it will continue spending. It will continue with arms deals with Saudi Arabia and Israel. You know, and of course, we have to remember the liberals were the same party that actively participated in the destruction of Yugoslavia and the invasion of Afghanistan and the coup in Haiti, and which voted for the bombing of Libya in 2011. Once again, on the side of the Harper Tories. You know, we have to talk about climate change. The Liberal Party has no plan to implement greenhouse gas emission targets federally. And they helped build Canada's reliance on fossil fuels in the first place. They're pro-tar sands and they're pro-pipeline. You know, so regardless of what they're doing around the latest climate change talks and inviting Elizabeth May and stuff like that, apparently that doesn't make a difference. In substantive terms, they're still pro-tar sands. They want to expand the tar sands, and they want to expand pipelines. They even were disappointed when Barack Obama vetoed the Keystone XL pipeline, as he did this week. Trudeau expressed regret at that. You know? And another thing, when it comes to First Nations, like, this was kind of all up in the air at the inauguration. I mean, them getting two young throat singers from Nunavut to perform, to put on basically a spectacle at this inauguration. You know, this whole, it was all supposed to be about, you know, supposedly the new government's respect for Aboriginal rights and things like that. And I myself, looking at the substantive terms at the question of national oppression in this country and ongoing colonialism, basically what I saw when that going on, I didn't see a cute spectacle, them bringing up these two kids to do, you know, Inuit throat singing. I saw a horrific thing, an abomination of a newly inaugurated king, so to speak, of Canada, you know, inviting his subject peoples, you know, and of course Aboriginal people in this country are basically subject to the federal government. You know, they are under the control of the federal government in this country. Him inviting those subject peoples to perform for him, to put on a spectacle for him. And really, that is a very disgusting thing. You know, it was the liberals who instituted a 2% cap on indigenous education in the 1990s that has led to the current crisis that Trudeau said he's going to deal with, and we have no indication on what substantial efforts he's going to make on that with regard to that. You know, the current government has same strong ties to the same oil and gas corporations that are continuing the colonial theft of Aboriginal land and poisoning indigenous communities. You know, when a First Nation's right to consent to any development that affects them, can we expect the Liberals to take a stand against big oil and fossil fuel development? Probably not, given what I just said about their positions when it comes to climate change. You know, and of course, when we talk about them establishing a commission into missing and murdered Aboriginal women, we've had commissions before on the federal and provincial level with regard to abuses of Aboriginal people. Like, usually they're drawn out over many, many years. And sometimes, you know, and oftentimes the recommendations are made by those commissions. It was the same thing with regard to the Commission on Residential Schools. Made all kinds of recommendations. None of them got followed through on. Nothing changed. Nothing. And beyond that, when it comes to like things like free trade, the Liberal government was what put NAFTA through and now supports the TPP and CETA. These new free trade agreements, which will undermine Canadian sovereignty still further. The Liberals are in favor of that. They voted for it. You know, they sided with Stephen Harper in favor of these free trade deals. And of course, then we have to talk about austerity and infrastructure spending. You know, you could say that the Liberal government ran to the left of the NDP in the last election on the issue of spending. You know, the NDP promised to balance the books and, like, you know, basically engage in fiscal conservatism. Meanwhile, Justin Trudeau said that he would not, you know, that he would run deficits and spend on infrastructure and things like that. But once again, we have to remember what infrastructure and for whose benefit. The usual liberal strategy, which they've pursued before, they pursued it in the 1990s, they pursued it in every government they basically ever run, is public-private partnerships. You know, basically public spending in conjunction with private corporations and developing infrastructure basically for corporate interests. This is what they want to do. The liberal government's recovery agenda is designed to benefit capitalism, not the people. Just after the election, the head of the Canadian Council of CEOs wrote an open letter to Trudeau, endorsing his infrastructure spending plan, provided that federal debt continues to be reduced in the long run. You know, monopoly, you know, what basically what corporate Canada wants is it wants public money to build infrastructure, including oil pipelines, that will benefit it in the long run. You know, not the Canadian people. This is not like things like healthcare or education or these kind of things, that kind of infrastructure. This is infrastructure that's really going to directly benefit the big corporations, you know, including pipeline constructors and the tar sands. You know, that's what they're talking about when it comes to infrastructure development. And that is not something that we should see as a progressive step forward. You know, and of course, to return to the issue of Aboriginal self-determination, if we compare the Canada's track record when it comes to Aboriginal rights and compared to the Soviet Union and its record on ensuring self-determination for national minorities, you know, historically oppressed and colonized national minorities within Russia or the former Russian Empire, you know, Canada is, its record is absolutely terrifying. You know, at the same time when Canada was implementing residential schools and trying to crush the life out of Aboriginal culture and society and basically destroy, genocidally destroy those nations, in Russia, in the Soviet Union, in the new Soviet Union, like, political and economic control was being put in the hands of those indigenous communities to develop their own to develop in their own way, to develop themselves, to develop their own culture. And in fact, there